It was the brainchild, to a degree, of Stephen A. Douglas of Illinois, although the notion had come up earlier. Lewis Cass had brought it up back in the campaign of 1848. Many Northerners said this violates the Missouri Compromise. This means that you're going to potentially open up some areas to slavery, some of the territories that the Missouri Compromise had said would be closed to slavery forever. It went beyond the stage of just debating this. There was tremendous violence associated with Kansas-Nebraska as pro-slavery people and anti-slavery people fought and killed each other in Kansas and along the Kansas-Missouri border. There was virtually a minor civil war that broke out to win control of the area. 1856, one of the more dramatic things that ever happened on the floor of either the House or the Senate occurred when Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts, after giving a powerful speech condemning what he called the crime against Kansas, that is perhaps allowing slavery into Kansas, was caned on the floor of the Senate by Preston Brooks, a representative from South Carolina, beaten into insensibility, literally covered with blood, collapsed on the floor. Charles Sumner, who was an abolitionist, left the Senate for 3 years as a result of this beating, and Massachusetts left his seat vacant. So there was Charles Sumner's empty seat in the Senate, a constant reminder, said people in the North, to the brutality and tendency toward violence on the part of white Southerners in the white South. They reacted by sending new canes to Preston Brooks and saying that he had upheld the honor of the South against a man who not only was impugning the whole region in his speech, but also had attacked personally a relative of Preston Brooks's. So the caning of Sumner, a major national event. That's 1856. In 1857, one of the most important Supreme Court cases in our history was decided. The Dred Scott decision, handed down by the Supreme Court, presided over by Roger B. Taney. The Dred Scott decision, in effect, said that no black person could be a citizen, said that the Missouri Compromise violated the Fifth Amendment's prohibition against taking property from people without due process, that is, by saying someone couldn't take their slave property into a part of the old Louisiana Purchase country, and also, in effect, said that Congress must protect slave property. What was at issue was the case of a slave named Dred Scott who was taken to free territory by his master, who then returned to slave territory. The question was whether Scott should have become free because he had lived on free territory. The Taney court said no. And this case alienated a significant part of the North. The abolitionists in the North went absolutely crazy about this. They said this is a perfect example of how a slave power conspiracy controls our government. The Supreme Court, which should be standing above special interests, has here waded in directly on the side of the slave owners, said people in the North. And that, they argued, is a bad situation. The slave power conspiracy, they said, is holding sway even though we outnumber them, and we're outnumbering them more and more. Something is wrong here. We have to curb this conspiracy. Part of the problem as we move through the 1840s and 50s is that the national institutions that generally had been looked to bring the nation together were failing. The church is split over the issue of slavery, many of them dividing in the 1840s and later. We get Northern Baptists and Southern Baptists, Northern Methodists and Southern Methodists, rather than just Baptists and Methodists. The Whig and Democratic parties broke down. Those parties had been national parties, also tending to hold things together because the parties would try to find compromises so they would have voters in both North and South. The second party system, the Whigs and Democrats, the first party system had been the Federalists and the Jeffersonian Republicans. This second national party system broke down under the strain of sectionalism. The Whigs ran their last serious presidential candidate in 1852. And the Democratic Party became an almost completely Southern-dominated sectional party as well, most of its national policies favoring the South. The Republican Party first ran a candidate in 1856, the Army officer and famous explorer John C. Fremont. The Republican Party is a sectional party. It has no appeal in the South. None. Its platform called for the banning of slavery from the territories. In Southern minds, the Republicans quickly became associated with abolitionists, though the two were by no means synonymous. But the party system then is breaking down. The national parties are no longer an influence holding things together, just as the churches are not. And finally, many people had grasped at the Supreme Court as the last hope for an institution that really would be above the sectional controversy, but Dred Scott showed that that was not the case either. Many in the North worried that they were almost hopeless in the face of this powerful slaveholding influence in the nation. They would point even to Northern men who were powerful politicians. Franklin Pierce, president, Democratic president from New Hampshire. James Buchanan, a Democratic president from Pennsylvania. But their policies were all pro-Southern, said many in the North who opposed them, Republicans and others. They're dough faces. That was the expression, the derisive expression applied to what were called Northern men of Southern principles. These are Northern men doing the bidding of their Southern masters, said many who opposed them. And here's a key element in the whole sectional controversy. Perceptions on each side had reached a point by the mid-1850s that scarcely allowed many Northerners and Southerners to view the other section in anything like sympathetic or even realistic terms. Each side expected the worst from the other. The White South looked north and saw a nation of abolitionists trying to kill the institution that was the foundation of the South's economic and social order. The North looked south and saw a land of aggressive slaveholders who, through the national courts and with dough-faced allies in Congress and the White House, frustrated the nation's progress in the modern world. There isn't much common ground, in a sense, as we move toward the end of the 1850s. I'll close with the observation that by 1859, a great many people, both North and South, had worked themselves into such a state that compromise would be very difficult if another great crisis did arise. When the election of 1860 brought to power a party that had called for closing off the territories to slavery, the Republican Party, just such a crisis had arrived. And how each side dealt with that crisis will be the subject of our next lecture.